My thanks again to Joseph Farrell for coming on the program. His new book, Covert Wars and the Clash of Civilizations, UFO Oligarchs and Space Secrecy. Check it out if you get a chance. It covers some of the same ground as our next guest. He was one of my favorite guests last year. It's been almost exactly a year since Brad Olson was on the program. He's an editor for World Explorer magazine, a travel writer and columnist, and his previous book, Future Esoteric, touched on many of the topics that are near and dear to our hearts here on Coast to Coast. His newest work, Modern Esoteric, takes it to a new level and is a little bit more optimistic about the future than what we've been hearing from Joseph Farrell. We'll jump right into it with Brad Olson right after this on Coast to Coast AM. There's a quote in the new book, Modern Esoteric, that I thought I'd mention as a way to start our conversation. It goes like this. It's from an Indian spiritual teacher. The search for reality is the most dangerous of all undertakings, for it destroys the world in which you live. Brad Olson, great to have you back on the show. I thought that might be a good place to start, because that's exactly what you do in your book, is sort of search for reality, and it does require us to destroy the world that we understand to be true.
Hey, George, it's great to talk to you again. And now that it's past midnight, I can say happy St. Patrick's
Day. Happy St. Patrick's
Day. Happy full moon.
Are you Irish?
I'm not, but, you know, everybody's a little bit Irish today.
I certainly am. But, we're talking about the modern esoteric. You address the idea of reality, perceived reality versus what it actually is. It's going to require some adjustments on all our part to come to grips with the kinds of things that you tackle in the new book, right?
Well, absolutely. And let me just start by saying this. Have you ever had the feeling that everything you thought you knew was a lie? Everything from history, science, government, banking, the money system, our law system, economics, farming, energy production, water treatment, healthcare, even spirituality. As we awaken to truth, we're realizing the beneficial information in all these areas has been suppressed and revised in order to keep us enslaved and dependent upon a corrupt debt-based system we can never pay off. And it's run by several private families, corrupt banksters, invest in a global wars to perpetuate the debt, control essential resources, and keep up the value for themselves. So, this is what I call the alternative narrative. When you just start to believe that all our fundamental belief systems are breaking down, and you kind of come to the realization that we're living in an illusion that's being perpetuated by these people, for me, I came to the conclusion that humanity has a right to know these things. And I've been very interested in these subjects. As you know, a year ago we spoke about Future Esoteric, which is actually book two in the series. Book one is Modern Esoteric, and this is where the story begins. This goes way back to the dawn of humanity and our very beginnings here on the planet and all the strange stories that accompany it. It's been called the Encyclopedia of Esoteric Topics, and I think that's a good examination. Of course, it doesn't read like an encyclopedia, but it contains all these things. And as you said in the setup piece, it also questions our very fundamental belief of what reality is.
Well, you cast a very wide net. Let's start this way. Esoteric meaning what? What do you mean by that?
Well, the Webster Dictionary definition is those subjects that are known to a select few or sought out by a select few. So, for example, like in Freemasonry, you can start at the very bottom tier, but to make it all the way up is really a lifelong pursuit. And until you get to those upper top tiers, you don't really know the whole basis and all the secrets held within Freemasonry. So this is something that's like an individual quest. This is something that people need to seek out for themselves. And when they do, they then obtain that power of knowledge.
You've got a chapter called Mythos of Creation. That's where that quotation I used from the Indian spiritual teacher came from, the search for reality being the most dangerous of undertakings. And you make a point in there about the exponential growth of information. I mean, how much we have learned here in a very short period, and how it's the pace of learning is increasing every day.
Well, that's exactly it. Yeah, the Moore's Law, that technology doubles upon itself every 18 months. And the same is true with our ability to search on the internet and to really seek out the kind of information that we want. I mean, I always think of the internet as kind of like the new Library of Alexandria, and let's hope it doesn't get burned down.
What information then, let's take it a step at a time. What information is being kept from us then? Let's start down the list. What is it that we don't know that we should know?
Well, where modern esoteric starts is basically looking at who we are as humans on this planet. And that goes back to even questioning whether or not the full story of evolution of us coming up from monkeys is true. The first section in modern esoteric is called lifeology. And that's a term I use rather loosely to examine the full scope of life on this planet, primarily humans, and primarily the steps up from basically some of the oddities, such as the Rh negative blood factor in the chapter called Blood of the Gods, which I'm hoping the producers of Ancient Aliens are listening to, because I'm trying to promote this as an idea for a show. But basically, 15% of humans have this Rh negative blood, and it's completely different than the 85% of humanity, which are Rh positive. And this actually runs in my family, George. I had a uncle, Douglas, who died when he was 5 days old because he was Rh negative, and this conflicted with my grandmother's blood, who was Rh positive. And he was what was known as a blue baby, and the blood had intermixed, and he died a few days after birth. Now, they do have shots you can take to prevent this, but up until the last 50 years ago, people like my Uncle Douglas would die at birth. Now, what makes this so incredibly interesting, to me at least, and is almost a smoking gun that our DNA has been tampered with, is that no animal in the animal kingdom has conflicting blood, only humans. And when you go a little bit deeper into this blood issue, the O Rh negative blood is the universal blood. It can be given to any other blood types, but those same blood types can only receive Rh negative O themselves, or they'll die. So it's these kind of little interesting tidbits that I've been looking into for the past 5 years working on the esoteric book series that really make me question everything we know. We think we know about ourselves might not be the real reality we're facing.
I want to hear more about this blood thing. I have A negative blood. That's my blood type. Is there something significant to that? What's your blood type again?
I'm actually A positive, but as I mentioned, we do have negative running in my family. And the fact that you are negative and that it runs in your family, George, as well as mine, there's a lot of interesting things about that. For example, we're more prone to be psychic. The negative types cannot be cloned. Things like your family has this history that goes through, because no DNA traits cannot be passed any other way but through your family. So this is like a little relic that has just been passed on for generation after generation after generation. And if you were to, say, have a child with a Rh negative or positive woman, you may have some problems with that birth, or you should certainly be aware of it. Because this is one of those things that not many people know about, but we have this very unique blood as a species, and the animal kingdom, no other animal has conflicting blood at all like this.
So your premise being that somebody messed with our blood somewhere along the way, our DNA, our genetic makeup, aliens or something, or visitors, or what are you saying?
Well, I'm saying that there is a very unusual trait among humans in our blood, which is in also in our DNA. And if it came from aliens tinkering with it, then that is something that should be explored more readily available by the experts. But the facts remain, we have this unique trait, and a lot of people don't realize it.
You mentioned in the book about superhuman DNA. What does that mean?
Well, meaning that some aspects of our DNA, mainly this the dark matter DNA, which is about 90% of our DNA, the 10% they know about are basically the proteins and the switches that occur throughout our lives, mainly when we're fetuses in the rapid development stage. And then for a long time, it was called junk DNA, and now they've changed it to dark DNA. And some things about that are very, very interesting, such as that it appears to work with our spiritual selves. And it, as I said in my setup piece, we're not being told the full story about spirituality. Even our religious institutions have seemingly failed us, at least in the West, and not telling us the complete picture of who we are as far as body, mind, and spirit. So I think when these are all put together, we're going to get a much more complete picture.
Well, let's jump into it now. What picture are we not getting, and what would you, how would you like to set that straight? Spiritual.
Well, in the Thrive section in the back of the book, I do have a chapter on reincarnation, and I think the evidence does point to the fact that we do have spirits within our body, and there is a moment when we die and the spirit can be actually captured with Carillion photography, and I have some books, some photos in the book of a spirit releasing from the body, and it's energy. That's what we're made up of, is energy. And this is what the masters have told us since time immemorial, is that everything is energy. And for a long time, it was all scoffed at. But what I find so interesting, George, is when the esoteric masters of old say something and it's scoffed at, and then later scientists in the 21st century confirm that indeed what you perceive to be as solid is really energy condensed. And so these things just have to fill my mind with curiosity. And when these data points all line up, it's kind of like a eureka moment. Like, well, of course it was. But on all appearances, I'm sitting on a couch. In front of me is a chair. Everything looks solid. I can bang my hand on it, and it feels solid. But we know it's not quite that way. That's why the subtitle of Modern Esoteric is Beyond Our Senses.
Yeah, but that's not a secret, is it? I mean, that's been around for a while.
What, that everything
that information
energy?
That's not esoteric, is it? It's that information's been kind of widely known for a while, or am I wrong on that?
Well, I think it is kind of just now becoming widely known that things are not as they appear in the material world. But in the 19th century, this kind of notion was scoffed at, that everything was energy and not really matter as we see or perceive it.
Brad, were you able to listen to Joseph Farrell's interview, the first part of the program?
I did not, but Joseph's a friend of mine, and I have read his books, and I have a feeling I know what he talked about.
We got into the secret space program a little bit, and that's also one of the things that you talk about in a chapter called The Alternative Narrative.
That's right.
Tell me your take on the secret space program, because you dug up some stuff from Brian O'Leary that I had not read before, and I've interviewed Brian. I spent a lot of time with him before he passed, and I found this to be pretty fascinating, his take on the secret space program.
Right. Well, just keep in mind that Joseph and I are researchers, and what we do is pile through tons of data and then condense it down into a workable, readable format. And the alternative narrative is the first chapter of the control section. And in that section, I wanted to give a basic general idea of many of the topics that we talked about in Future Esoteric, because that's actually book two in the series, and Modern Esoteric, which just came out, is book one, but Future Esoteric was more developed and needed to come out sooner. So as far as the secret space program, of course they have it. I mean, we've been backward engineering a lot of this technology that's been recovered from down crafts and elsewhere for upwards of 70 years. And then when you tie in Joseph's research on the Nazis and what they had and some of the advanced science they were working on in the 1930s, and then you fast forward to 70 years later, they're hundreds of years ahead of us in this secret space program. They're not telling anybody about it. Well, I was talking to my friend David Hatcher Childress about this last summer. Joseph knows him well, too. David publishes Joseph's books. And we were talking about the secret space program. He goes, you know where they get the recruits for those off-planet missions? I said, no. He said that they recruit them from the submarine Navy forces, and they're already acclimated to working in pressurized environments, in constrained spaces. So they look for single men without kids, preferably orphans, and they go on these top secret missions with Solar Warden and the various ships we have in the secret space air fleet. And this is basically what Gary McKinnon tapped into when he got into the Johnson Space Center around 1999-2000. He got caught in 2001. And he said he was looking at the registers, how they were moving goods, and the officers who were called non-terrestrial officers, and he even saw some of the ships. One of them was like a large cigar-shaped craft. So these things are real. Joseph is much more of an authority on this than I am. I'm taking a bigger, wider umbrella, as you said, and trying to tie together all of these subjects, whether they be very ancient, such as I present in Modern Esoteric, or from the 20th century, 21st century and forward, which is the perspective of Future Esoteric.
Well, the quote I'm talking about from Brian O'Leary, and I realize it's been a while since you wrote this book, but in Modern Esoteric on page 191, you have a quote from Brian O'Leary saying he had taken a tour of Merritt Island, of this facility there, isolated from the NASA structures. He said he toured this Air Force Center and learned about their secret space program, that they had this, our tour of the facility seemed like a broken record, computers, consoles, rockets, similar to NASA's. And it struck me, Brian O'Leary said, that the whole thing was an unnecessary duplication. Imagine two independent but similar programs going on at the same time. The Air Force space program seemed like a foreign space program, except we were spending dearly for it. So I just had never heard before Brian O'Leary or anyone else who had been an astronaut and under NASA admit that they had seen evidence of another space program separate from NASA's.
Yeah, well, I got that right out of his 1971 book, The Making of an Ex-Astronaut. And he's the only astronaut who quit. And isn't it also ironic that he was a big proponent of free energy and basically had to live his last years out of this country somewhat in exile? So this is kind of what happens when you're an insider whistleblower. If you decide to make that decision to tell this information, you may have to be running for your life.
We're talking with Brad Olson about his new, not new book, but one of his new books, Modern Esoteric. Beyond Our Senses, much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM. We're talking with Brad Olson about his book, Modern Esoteric, which, as I said in the introduction, covers a heck of a lot of ground. One of the chapters dealing with rethinking history, all the things we learned about human history that are wrong. We're going to jump into that when we come back here on Coast to Coast AM. Brad Olson, in your book, Modern Esoteric, you have a section on rethinking history. History is a Mississippi of lies, Voltaire said. And you write that that we really need to rethink the whole thing. Well, give me some examples. What do we have that's wrong, and how is it that it ended up wrong?
Well, I should backtrack just a little bit and say that three books that I wrote before the esoteric series were on sacred places. There was a North America book, Europe book, and Around the World book. And this was predicated on my traveling around the world for 3 years in the 1990s self-funded trip I did. And it brought me to a lot of these places personally. And the one place that is still on my mind almost every day is the Great Pyramid in Egypt. It is just one of those monuments that is so unlike any other megalithic site in the world. And the more I learn about it, the more it just, the rabbit hole just goes deeper and deeper and deeper with this, mainly because of the way it's designed, the way it's located on the earth, the way it's constructed in such a precise form. The four cardinal compass points are the four sides of the pyramids. The sacred geometry that goes into a Fibonacci spiral with the other two pyramids there on the Giza Plateau. It goes on and on. So this is what really got me interested in some of these esoteric subjects, was this whole notion of rethinking our history. And when you look at cultures like Egypt, and even Sumeria, they came onto the scene in a very refined, advanced stage, and then went through a period of breaking down their culture and their legacy as far as what they knew technologically speaking. So in other words, the oldest relics of ancient Egypt are the greatest ones. And then, as I saw along the banks of the Nile, there are many other pyramids in Egypt, but all of them are inferior to the Great Pyramids. So this is kind of the idea behind rethinking history, as well as all the artifacts that have been found in various places around the world that were embedded in the coal when they're blasting a mine somewhat recently, about a year or two ago, somebody was burning coal and he found a chunk of coal with these gears in it. And I have a picture of it in the back of the Rethinking History chapter of those gears. And he turned it into some archaeologists and looked at it and they said, well, where did you get this? And then they found out that the coal that it had came from was very, very old. So to look at this in a different lens is to see that we haven't been told the full story as far as the high civilizations that may have been here, as well as extraterrestrial visitors who may have come here a long, long time ago. Then another really fascinating aspect are the giants that have been found. Now, I'm a really tall guy. I'm 6'7". Everybody always says, you must play basketball. You're really tall. Well, some of these relics that they found are 3 or 4 meters tall. I'm just barely over 2 meters tall, so twice as big as me. We're talking 10 to 12 feet tall, some of these giants. And I have pictures of them in the book as well, some of these mummies. Now, they have done a great job, and I say they, meaning the Smithsonian in this country, have done a great job collecting all of these mummified and buried giants in this country. And dozens of them have been found in the mound sites along the Mississippi and Ohio River valleys. And of course, this was very fascinating to me when I was working on Sacred Places North America, all of these out-of-place artifacts that they found, or UPAs, as they're called. Not only that, but skeletons wearing armor and artifacts, and they just all go missing. So I'm trying to piece together this story based on the evidence that is remaining and how we can tie together this narrative into the larger picture of these esoteric subjects.
You use a term, prefabricated societies, through history, that are, there are a couple of them that just seem to pop out of nowhere. What do you mean?
Say again?
You think they had help?
Well, it would seem that if they were coming out of the gates in their highest refined form, that they were a legacy of something previous. In Egypt, for example, it's known as the Osirian Empire, which was a legacy of those survivors of Atlantis, as the story goes. Now, I have another chapter in the lifeology section of Modern Esoteric called Lost Continents, and I examine all the evidence for lost civilizations that have been here, talking about the geography of the planets, how the plates move quite frequently, pole shift scenarios, meteorite hits, periods where the planet goes into ice ages and then comes back out and warms, how the magnetic pole is now shifting towards Siberia, which may indicate that another pole shift could be imminent. I mean, it could be hundreds of years or even thousands of years, but the fact that it is moving very quickly towards Siberia is a little bit cautionary that this is happening, you know, because, of course, the poles are usually very stable. And then, but also in the Lost Continents chapter about a lot of underwater archaeology off of Okinawa, they found underwater ruins. Off of Bimini, Rhodes is an archaeological site. You can scuba dive underwater, as well as reported glass pyramids in the Atlantic that may also be Atlantean ruins. And the most fascinating one, which I have photos at the end of the Lost Continents chapter, is off of Cuba, which was detected using side scan radar. And they have found what looks like a Mayan city 2,000 feet underwater. So these kind of things just blow my mind when they come up in the news, and they do slowly percolate up. And then I heard National Geographic was going to take over this this find off of Cuba, and then you don't hear about it anymore. And that's kind of suspicious, kind of like Smithsonian going after the giants.
Yeah, sometimes National Geographic is, you know, it's a wonderful organization, but it's sometimes is not very sympathetic and open-minded about some of the more esoteric sort of topics, I think. Tell me this, is it your premise that these early civilizations, Egyptians, Sumerians, whatever, had some help from somewhere else, got real advanced, and then the helpers, the others, whoever they are, left? Or what?
Or maybe never left. Because reportedly below the Great Pyramids on the Giza Plateau is a huge series complex of underground bases, for lack of a better word. But there are an enormous amount of chambers, and they've already detected this. It was called Nile Gate. Basically, when I was there in the 1990s, well, first, this guy named, German guy named Gattenbrink, had this little, basically a robot that went up the air chambers in the Great Pyramid and found a door stopping this little device. And it even had like a metal fastener. So it was obviously intentionally built into it. But more importantly, they were scanning around the Giza Plateau and found quite a few cavities underneath there. Well, underneath there is reportedly legendary site of the Hall of Records. And what is contained in those Hall of Records, I don't really know, but apparently it's something of a very high-tech nature, more high-tech than we can imagine in our advanced society as of today, which would lead me to conclude what you just said, that there were helpers involved in all this.
So what happened to make them go away or not be as obviously present? I mean, we don't have evidence of them helping us build buildings now. Maybe it happens, but it's not out in the open. What happened? Do you know?
Well, yeah, I see what you're saying. Well, perhaps they don't want to be so overtly known or involved in our modern building of cities and so forth, but you gotta understand, back in the time of Egypt, the world population was only a few dozen million compared to 7 billion today. So the population, the human population, was very small. So it would have been a lot easier to control a smaller group. For example, if we're talking about ET intervention in some of these megalithic sites. And then just on the topic of megalithic sites, and I do have photos of these in the book as well, places over in South America, such as Sacsayhuaman and Machu Picchu and around Cuzco, some of these massive blocks that are so precisely fit that you can't even put a razor blade in between them. And they're so oddly shaped, yet they fit so precisely, leads me to believe that someone had an incentive to build on a megalithic level. But they don't do that today. In fact, the largest megalithic blocks in the world are at a site called Baalbek in Lebanon. And the blocks are so huge that even the most modern crane today could not have moved them. So you see this regression in technology up until this modern age, and we're saying, well, how the heck did they move that? And we still don't have the technology to do it ourselves. In fact, they tried to build a replica of the Great Pyramid in Japan about a decade ago, and they failed miserably. They couldn't even do a small-scale model of it, let alone something on that scale.
Tell me about your premise being that history has sort of been polluted, obfuscated, confused. The reality of those ancient civilizations kind of been distorted by modern scientists and academics. How did that work? How did they keep an intrepid archaeologist from sort of clearing things up? I guess it happens where people like Graham Hancock or David Hatcher Childress, they write about this stuff and it just doesn't get a whole lot of traction with academic types. But how is that cover-up maintained and why?
Well, first of all, it's coming from a place where information is controlled. And if you are, say, a university archaeologist and you're going on a dig somewhere and you find something very unusual, you will ultimately have to report to your peers. And you ultimately have a salary that comes from those same sources. So if your peers don't like your conclusions, say you find a crystal skull down in Belize and it has all these properties that some of the crystal skulls have that just don't fit into mainstream science or archaeology, then it's dismissed and it's not used. Just like I was saying about finding all these giants. How are you going to explain that? What are you going to do with it? I mean, we're talking about a complete rethinking of history, hence the name of the chapter, because all these out-of-place artifacts just don't fit in the standard model that we were taught in school. But taken together, we see that indeed, if an artifact is found deep in a cave embedded in rock, as well as some of these giant bones that are very, very old, it doesn't matter if there's a cover-up because it is what it is. And it's like the old saying about truth. You can pack all the lies and disinformation you want on it, but truth is always going to stand tall throughout history. It can be clouded over. It can be disguised. But in the end, all that stuff just washes away and truth just stands tall. And it's like all this evidence. You just can't brush it under the rug. And therefore, we have to take the bold steps of rethinking who we are and what the history is on this planet. And when we do that, we reach some very startling conclusions, which I present in the book.
You mentioned that gear. I found the reference to it, this gear. In January 2013, the Voice of Russia reports a 300-million-year-old piece of aluminum machinery was found in Vladivostok. And the expert said this gear rail had to be manufactured, could not have been created by natural forces. So how is that treated? It gets reported by the Voice of Russia. How does an archaeologist or a paleontologist, how do they explain that stuff, or do they just choose to ignore it?
They just choose to ignore it, George. That's what's so bewildering about all this. Because, once again, it ties into this whole alternative view of who we are and a high-tech society being here long, long ago, and then the possible tie-in with extraterrestrials. They just don't want to touch this. But these things keep popping up, like this new story in 2013. You would think it would be on the cover of National Geographic. I doubt they even made it a little sidebar story.
Back to the giants. You said the Smithsonian has a pretty good collection of giants or skeletons of giants?
I'm not sure they collect them or even keep them. They probably just get rid of them. But who knows? Maybe they do keep them. I hope they do. But since there is such scant record of it in this continent, I think we need to look down to South America and Mexico. In Mexico, there was the Star Child skull that was found in the 1930s, and the late, great Lloyd Pye did a lot of presentations about that, getting this information out. And then the elongated skulls that have been found down around Nazca and Peru, you know, where those enigmatic lines are way up high in the Altiplano.
Right.
There's a whole museum there right next to the Nazca lines where they have a dozen of these giant elongated skulls. And I just posted a picture on Facebook the other day of an elongated skull, one of these Peruvian skulls next to Nefertiti. And it's like a dead ringer because if you recall Akhenaten, the pharaoh in Egypt who bucked the trend, he was the first pharaoh to propose a monotheistic religion, had a big elongated skull. So did his wife. So did their children. And it could be argued that they were somehow related to these Peruvian skulls that were found.
I know the Star Child skull, that's a different story, but at least in some of these elongated skulls, it was something that ancient peoples did. They put these braces on their heads to create that look. Maybe they were trying to emulate aliens or something, but I mean, they created this, the system where their skulls would turn out like that, didn't they? At least for some of them.
Well, there is that technique of doing that, wrapping the head. But these are much larger than humans, and they also have a different cranium structure. For example, we have like these cracks in our skull, not really cracks, but basically where the two plates join, there's a seam. And in humans, it's basically one that comes up from the forehead to the back of the head and then separates off of two lines. Well, these skulls down in Peru had completely different makeup of those lines. Plus, they showed no signs of being wrapped or worked in a fashion where they would be elongated like that. Plus, they were much larger than humans' skulls as well, which you could make the case that these were among some of those giants.
This Star Child skull, of course, pretty interesting. Lloyd Pye has been our guest on this program previously. I had a chance to interview him here and see the skull in person. That's a pretty interesting story. And I had some pretty big questions, but I guess since I saw Lloyd and did the TV story about him, there had been DNA testing that raised some interesting possibilities about that skull. We'll talk about that after the break. With my guest Brad Olson, and we'll open up phone lines with your questions about the book Modern Esoteric. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM.